The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Who was Malcolm Clark?
Malcolm Clark was born in 1817 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He grew up in sort of the area around downtown Minneapolis-St. Paul, present day, at Fort Snelling, which was an outpost on the sort of the extreme western frontier of the United States at that time. He was a rough outdoors type, loved to hunt, loved to trap animals, was fascinated by local indigenous peoples, also there kind of developed the code of honor that I think shaped his life for good and for ill, that led him into some trouble, most significantly at West Point. His father fought very hard to get Malcolm admitted to the U.S. Military Academy and ultimately got Malcolm in, but promptly thereafter, he was expelled for challenging a classmate to a duel. He was reinstated, got a reprieve from none other than Andrew Jackson, who was president at the time. But Clark could not stay out of his own way, got in a fight the next year, was expelled for good, made his way to Texas right after the Revolution there. And when that didn't pan out, he ultimately made his way to the Upper Missouri, where he arrived around 1840, working for the American Fur Company.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, and my guest this time is Andrew Graybill. We're talking about his book, The Red and the White, A Family Saga of the American West. You are on a hunt for information about a different project, actually doing research in Helena, Montana, I believe, at the Historical Society. When you discovered the story of Clark, why did you abandon your previous project and go with this one?
So I'd gone up to Helena on a really lovely fellowship, a one-month stay paid for by the Society to work in their collections. And I'd gone to work on the Cypress Hills Massacre, which I thought was going to be very useful in helping to explain the hardening of the U.S.-Canada border after 1873 and kind of the different trajectories those two Wests took, the Mild West of Canada, the Wild West of the United States. I found some stuff, but it wasn't very interesting to me, so I quit. And one day, I started to thumb through the other collections of the Historical Society and wondering where I might start my random hunting through the files. I thought of James Welch's book, Fool's Crow, which I had just taught at the University of Nebraska, which I'd read probably a dozen times by that point. And what I wanted to do that day was to see if Malcolm Clark was a real person. Welch's book is a wonderfully researched and detailed piece of historical fiction, and it's based on some real events like the Marias Massacre of January 1870. But one of the ways that we get to the Marias Massacre and the story that James Welch tells is through the murder of Malcolm Clark, and he was killed on his ranch in Helena in front of his family in 1869. And what I wanted to find out that day when I'd taken a break from the research on the Cypress Hills Massacre was whether Clark was a real person or whether James Welch had invented him as a convenient device to move the story along. And I found out not only that Clark was real and that he was even more important perhaps than Welch had suggested, but also that he had this fascinating family. And so I've been sort of obsessed with the Clarks ever since.
Let's define who these people are. We know Malcolm Clark is the patriarch of this family, but we need to know about the Indian woman he married. And she is from the Blackfoot Confederacy, is what it's called. But it's made up of three groups of people that live on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. It's all quite confusing. Can you just clear up with that?
It is, absolutely. Part of it is sort of deciding singular or plural. It's always the Blackfoot Confederacy, the Blackfeet. The use of that term is going to be found normally in the United States. Blackfoot is the term that Canadians seem to prefer when referring to the First Nations on their side of the line. So the Blackfoot Confederacy was composed of three different groups. The Blackfoot proper, called the Siksika, and I won't pretend that I have the perfect pronunciation of these names, the Bloods, or the Kaina in their tongue, also known as the Many Chiefs, or the Piegans, also known as the Pekunis, which is a term that many Montana Indians who are of pagan background would call themselves, which means scabby robes. Don't know exactly what that means, but it must refer to the buffalo trade somehow. So these three groups lived in an area that straddled what becomes the international boundary between the United States and Canada, from the Saskatchewan River in the north all the way to the Teton Range in northwestern Wyoming in the south, east of the Rocky Mountains. And the Siksika and the Kainas lived north of what becomes the international boundary. And the Piegans were split on both sides of what becomes the 49th parallel. I keep saying that over and over again because they predate the arrival of American and Canadian surveyors. They, their homeland is bifurcated, bisected by the imposition of the border. So there are North Piegans and then South Piegans, whom in who would be the Blackfeet in Montana, as they are thought of. The Blackfeet Reservation, on the Blackfeet Reservation live Piegans, but they're technically South Piegans, with North Piegans above the line. Does that do anything to sort out that?
Sure.
There are lots of maps that will show both the historical range of the Blackfeet, or Blackfoot if you're in Canada, but also the present-day location of their reservation in the United States and their reserves, different term in Canada.
So this particular group of people lived in a place that was really one of the last to be invaded by settlers and fur trappers. And explain why that is.
Yes. So the Blackfeet had been resistant to encroachment on their territory by other Indians, by people of mixed ancestry, the Métis, and also by whites, from pretty much the time that they came in full control of their territory in the mid-18th century. In fact, it's the one group that Lewis and Clark strived to avoid on their famous exploration of the Louisiana Purchase. They were known to be reflexively hostile to interlopers. So Lewis and Clark had sought to avoid them, but Lewis ends up encountering a group of six or eight Piegans on his way back in July 1806. And it's the only episode of Native white violence on the journey involves Lewis and this small group of Blackfeet. Thereafter, the Blackfeet were especially suspicious of Americans, whom they called the Long Knives, more tolerant of Canadians, but basically tried to keep whites and, again, other Indians of the Métis at bay so they could protect both buffalo, on which they depended for their subsistence, but also their access to the beaver. And the Americans forced that issue by continuing to press into the Upper Missouri Territory to get at the mother lode of the beaver population. In Canada, the British usually let, through the Hudson's Bay Company, the Indians come to them. The Americans, starting in the 18-teens, begin to invade Blackfeet territory with some pretty dire early results.
And we'll come back to those results. But I want to go back to the Piegans and Malcolm Clark. He married a young Piegan woman. And I'd like you to read a passage that tells how that happened.
Sure. I'd be happy to. Little is known for certain about the girl, except that her name was Kothkokona, and that her parents were a Piegan warrior named Underbull and his wife, Black Bear. Kothkokona was probably born around 1825, the same year that the Erie Canal joined the Great Lakes to the Hudson River, and that John Quincy Adams assumed the presidency after prevailing in a bitter electoral struggle against Andrew Jackson. However, like most Native people of the time and place, Kothkokona is almost entirely absent from written historical records, appearing in a letter here, a census record there, maybe a pioneer reminiscence of the frontier era. Still, it's possible to sketch the contours of her early existence given the rhythms of Piegan life during the first few decades of the 19th century. Shortly after Kothkokona's birth, Underbull called upon a person of distinction within the tribe to choose a name for his child, building his guest a sweat lodge and bestowing presents upon him, waiting for the namer to suggest a handful of monikers from which he, as the father, chose. Thereafter, Underbull was probably a more distant figure in Kothkokona's world. If she had brothers, he spent more time with them, teaching the boys how to hunt and fight. On almost all matters, Kothkokona would have looked to Black Bear and other female relatives for guidance. And she knew hard work from a young age, gathering berries, collecting wood, carrying water, mending clothes, stitching lodges, and building trappy. When she was a bit older, her mother, or in her absence another female relative, taught Kothkokona the most important skill known to Blackfeet women: tanning a buffalo hide. Such expertise was necessary, of course, for basic survival. After all, bison skins gave the Indians clothing and shelter and brought them trade goods from the Napiquans. Tanning was also important as a marital prerequisite, for Blackfeet men relied upon their wives to dress the animals they killed. So critical was the work of Indian women that, as the robe trade increased, so did the practice of polygyny, whereby native men acquired additional spouses and at increasingly younger ages in order to meet their growing labor needs. Dressing a buffalo hide was a messy and backbreaking task, as Kothkokona learned. Once she tore the skin from an animal's body, a native woman fleshed the hide by staking it to the ground, hair side down, with wooden pegs and scraping away any bits of tissue, fat, or dried blood, an exhausting and time-consuming process. She then left the skin to bleach in the sun for several days before scraping it again to achieve a uniform thickness. Finally, she applied a mixture of brains and fat to soften the hide before smoothing it out with strokes from a rough stone. It took 2 full days of work to tan a single robe. As in earlier native white encounters throughout North America, some newcomers to the upper Missouri were appalled by the division of labor among the Blackfeet, believing that men's hunting was a form of leisure or sport, while their wives were treated like drudges and forced to do the heavy lifting required for the trade in animal skins. Although life for Piegan women was undeniably hard, beyond tanning hides and preparing food, they were also responsible for child-rearing. The prejudice and chauvinism of most European and American outsiders make such accounts problematic at best. And it's worth noting that some later observers emphasized the essential role of Piegan women in religious and ceremonial rites. As Kothkokona reached puberty, Black Bear instructed her daughter on the rituals of courtship and marriage. Thereafter, the husband enjoyed almost total control over his wife or wives. To impress upon her daughter the importance of a woman's marital conduct, Black Bear might have held up to Kothkokona the powerful example set by a medicine woman. This individual was a chief figure in the annual sun dance, the tribe's most important religious ceremony. In order to qualify, a woman had to possess unimpeachable character, marked especially by unwavering devotion to her husband. And yet for Kothkokona and other girls of marrying age, it was likely the punishment for female adultery that made the stronger impression. As Prince Maximilian of Weed recorded in his journal, quote, "Men punished the infidelity of their women swiftly and severely. They cut off their noses, and one saw many such horribly disfigured faces among the Piegans." Surely Kothkokona took note of them. Despite Black Bear's prominent role in raising Kothkokona and preparing her for marriage, it was Underbull who ultimately chose a suitable husband for their daughter once she reached her teens. And like many other prominent Blackfeet men in the 1830s and 1840s, he did not select a young and distinguished warrior for his son-in-law, but opted instead for a fur trader named Malcolm Clark, whom the Indians called Nisukayu, or Forebears.
Why would he do that?
The short answer is economics. At that time, after the Blackfeet, with repeated overtures from various white traders, had finally accepted a limited Anglo-American presence among them on the upper Missouri, it became very clear to the Indians, and of course to the whites alike, the economic benefits of intermarriage. Through marrying his daughter to a white fur trader, especially one who was as successful as Malcolm Clark had already proven to be in his 3 or 4 years on the upper Missouri, this guaranteed Underbull access to the trade goods that Malcolm Clark had, which he would exchange for the beaver and later buffalo skins that Underbull and also all of his sons would provide Malcolm Clark. These were things that ranged from knives, tea kettles, guns, liquor, all kinds of manufactured goods that the Europeans and the Anglo-Americans had that the Indians did not. And getting access to those goods made life easier for starters, but it also meant that Underbull could distribute those goods among his people in a form of patronage, which would assure his own position within the tribe. So economics had a lot to do with it.
But they paid a really heavy price in that now they were dependent on the white traders for gunpowder and other things.
You're quite right. Once the Indians had become dependent upon these European trade goods, guns require gunpowder. Plus, once you've used a kettle, it's hard to imagine all the effort that is used to otherwise, you know, bring water to a boil and to sustain its warmth. And you could go on and on down the line. Provided lots of relief from the difficulty of a frontier existence, but it did create dependency. And perhaps the most devastating thing that happened to the Blackfeet, like many other Plains tribes, of course, is that by having the whites among them, by bringing their trade goods and such, they brought also with them, unwittingly, smallpox, which had a devastating effect on a variety of Indian peoples of the Northern Plains. few suffered more than the Blackfeet, but of course, in earlier epidemics, the Mandans, the Hidatsas, the Crows, every group on the northern plains experienced the ravages of smallpox.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Andrew Graybill, author of The Red and the White, A Family Saga of the American West. We'll continue our conversation right after a short break. Stay with us. About the use of the word red as a descriptor for American Indians, other than it's more succinct and maybe a little bit more poetic to pair it with white in the title, is there another reason why that word was chosen?
There are two ways that I can answer that question. The first way is to say, as I'm sure you know, publishers and marketing departments get a hold of these books and decide what they will be called, usually in consultation with the author, not always. I had been working on this book for several years with the tentative title of A Mixture of So Many Bloods, A Family Saga of the American West. The mixture of so many bloods part was pulled from a letter Helen Clark, one of Malcolm Clark's daughters, had written in the early 20th century. I thought it was very evocative. She was complaining about the ways in which so-called Americans, who themselves were composed of a variety of ethnicities and such, as she puts it, arrogated to themselves a power of racial purity, or something along those lines. And she said that actually Americans were a mixture of bloods. Breeds is the word that she used, actually. But I first read it as bloods, and breed sounded a little bit too harsh for a book title. So I'd been working on that. That was the assumption that we published with the book. But in the end, my editor liked something else when he was rereading the final manuscript. And this was also based on some primary material. A woman named Helen Fitzgerald Sanders, who was a good friend, a white friend of Helen Clark's, wrote a book called The White Quiver, published in the 19-teens. And her book is sort of a mystical, somewhat creaky, but for the times probably typical story about the Piegans, Helen Clark's mother's people. And in the epigraph to that book, she dedicated the White Quiver to Horace, but especially to Helen Clark, in whose character mingles the best of the white race and the red. So this is actually drawn from the time and from the place. It has a historical sort of sensibility to it.
I want to go back to Malcolm Clark and his family. Give us a very quick overview of what happened with Malcolm and how he was murdered, and then what happened with his children.
Okay. So so Malcolm Clark retires from the fur trade in the early 1860s after another violent episode. He kills the son of his former boss, a young man named Owen McKenzie. And at that time, Clark retires to a ranch north of Helena in the Prickly Pear Valley. And he's living there with his wife and his second wife and their children when he's murdered in August 1869 by his wife's cousin, an Indian named Pete Alchild, for reasons that remain hotly debated even today. Clark was very prominent, among the most prominent white men in the territory, and this murder happens against the backdrop of escalating Piegan white violence because of an influx of white gold seekers in the 1860s. And the U.S. Army officials in the area, plus other traders and white settlers, believe that if Malcolm Clark can be killed on his ranch in front of his own family, when supposedly he'd been a real friend to the Indians, no whites were safe. This ultimately kicks the Army war machine into gear and leads to the tragic Marias Massacre of January 23rd, 1870, in which 173 or more Piegans are killed in a winter camp at the Big Bend in the Marias River, utterly defenseless, many of them suffering from smallpox, most of the able-bodied men away on a hunt trying to find some bison to feed the camp. Malcolm Clark's own two sons of mixed ancestry participate. They ride with the 2nd U.S. Cavalry that day and thus participate in the slaughter of their own blood relatives. After that, and this is a large portion of the book, I track what happens to Clark's descendants, his 2 children and 1 of his grandsons, their experience as peoples of mixed ancestry in a time and a place, the U.S. West, during this period after the Civil War and Reconstruction, that's being pulled into the orbit of the United States, and how the space for peoples of mixed Indian white ancestry really contracts sharply and is replaced by a much more binary racial formulation where you are either white or Indian, but there is little room increasingly for people in between.
This book is fascinating for many reasons, and I was especially intrigued by the story behind Glacier National Park.
Ultimately, it's the product of probably 2 men, a host of others as well, but George Grinnell, who fell in love with it in 1885, and then Louis Hill, who, just as Yellowstone is developed in large part with the help of a railroad that wants to promote the area and thus promote the line, the same thing happens with Louis Hill and the Great Northern. And ultimately, there are a lot of twists and turns in the story, but the fascinating part that intersects with the Clarks is that the property on which the Glacier Park Lodge sits today, that gorgeous, magnificent structure with the golf course nearby, sits on a piece of land that was sold to Louis Hill by Horace Clark, who was one of the first settlers in Midvale, which is later renamed East Glacier Park. So the Clarks are etched into the landscape of northern Montana, and there are features in the park that are named for them. Helen Lake in the northern park, Mount Helen, which is in the upper Two Medicine Valley, Lake Isabel, which is named for Horace and Helen's sister, Isabel, which is located in the southwestern corner of the park. There's a way in which they're very much alive even today.
Another part of the story of Glacier National Park is the way that land along the eastern side was wrested away from the Indians because somebody, I don't know who, the U.S. government, thought there was gold there.
Right. So the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana continues to shrink throughout the 19th century, and ultimately its boundaries in the late 19th century are largely what they are today, except for the fact that there is this strip on one side of the park that is desperately coveted by the U.S. Geological Survey because of the belief that there could be some valuable minerals there. So George Grinnell, who had spent a fair amount of time up here, he's the editor of Forest and Stream magazine, which becomes Field and Stream. He was a very prominent ethnographer, early anthropologist. He had spent time out here. He'd fallen in love with the Glacier Park area, what becomes Glacier Park, in the 1880s when he visits the Swift Current Valley and is just moved and uses pretty purple language to describe the scene before him. At any rate, Grinnell is fascinated by this area, wants to see it set aside as a national park. He refers to this area as the crown of the continent. But before that can happen, the territory needs to be acquired. And of course, this is a plan that Grinnell claims perhaps not to have developed from the moment that he saw the area, but he had an interest in it and seeing the United States government acquire it. So ultimately, in the sad part of the story, the brutal part of the story that involves the Clarks, in fact, is that in negotiating for the sale of this piece of land, ultimately called the Ceded Strip, the U.S. treaty negotiators, one of whom was George Grinnell, the Blackfeet come and suggest they'll sell it for $3 million. And according to the story, Grinnell says that, and the other commissioners say that they'll sell it for $1.5 million. And threatened to withhold the rations for the Blackfeet, who were starving at this time with the disappearance of the bison, the advent of the reservation system, and so on. And Helen Clark, there's no record of what she says or what she does, but it's known that she was there. Apparently, she counsels the Blackfeet to accept the offer, as bad as it seems, because she knows the coercive power of the federal government, having deployed it herself down in Indian territory where she had worked as an allotting agent. And while some might say it's hard to believe that Helen Clark would sell out her mother's people that way, there are others, including some I've spoken to on the reservation, who say that she did what she did out of love because she knew that they were starving and she knew that the government meant business and would indeed withhold these rations and starve the Blackfeet into agreeing to sell this piece of land that ultimately becomes Glacier National Park.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit more about Helen. She was the first woman elected to public office in Montana, is that right?
Yes. So when I set out to write the book, it was ultimately Helen's story that's the one that most captivated me. I think it was probably in digging around in her papers in the Montana Historical Society that convinced me that this was a book that I wanted to do. So Helen has this fascinating life. After her father's murder in 1869, she heads east. At that point, she would have been in her early 20s. And she enjoys a brief but acclaimed career on the Broadway stage. She was described by one contemporary, and I love this, quote, 5 feet and 10 inches of magnificent womanhood. But apparently it wasn't just her stature, but also her voice, which was unusually deep and thrilling, that gave her a real presence when she was on stage. She stayed in New York City until probably about 1875, came back to Montana, taught for several years in the schools, and then in 1882 becomes the first woman elected to office in the history of Montana Territory when she's elected to serve as a superintendent of schools for Lewis and Clark County, which is Helena's the county seat. She does that for the better part of the 1880s, and then has an even more unusual position when she goes to Indian Territory, present-day Oklahoma, and serves as an allotting agent, helping to break up the communal lands of groups like the Poncas, the Otos, the Tonkawas, and other groups that have been especially resistant to the idea of allotment. And what's so interesting about this to me is that Helen Clark is only the second woman that I know of who serves as an allotting agent and the only person of Indian or mixed ancestry. There were Indian peoples who worked in the Indian service, but in much lower level jobs. I think it's fascinating that Helen was, as far as I can tell, sui generis, the only person of Indian background, let alone and a woman at that, who is invested with this power of the federal government. And she spends most of the 1890s in Indian Territory before coming back finally and permanently to Montana in the early 20th century.
How would you summarize the long-term influence of Malcolm Clark?
One of the things that's fascinating about Clark, and he's a character who's hard to put your arms around because I think on some levels he is he's noble. He is certainly very capable. He becomes a very important fur trader, but he's also something of a scoundrel and a hothead. And there's a way in which his presence here, it's always hard to know because events are so contingent, but it's hard to see a straight line to the Baker Massacre or the Marias Massacre. It's known by both names. Without Clark's murder at his ranch because of his stature and because of his importance. And I think the thing about him also that really sticks out for me in thinking about the sweep of Montana history from the mid-19th century to the present day is the fact that Clark was one of the original 10 or 12 founders of the Montana Historical Society. So he and guys like Granville Stewart invested this society in 1865, I believe, to study the past, which for them consisted of mining ventures, cattle ranching, prospecting, and the fur trade. But it built an institution which exists today and which has ended up preserving the history of his really fascinating and remarkable family.
Andrew Graybill is an associate professor of history and director of the William P. Clements Center for Southwest Studies at Southern Methodist University near Dallas, Texas. Look for more information about him at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.